Carrie is with, I'll probably get this wrong, the University Communications.
Right.
And is going to explain to us how to deal with media, which can be intimidating and terrifying, but can also be a really good experience for both the person sharing the information and the people getting the information. So thank you for coming to talk to us.
Sure. Well, thanks for the invitation. I appreciate it. I'm flattered to be asked to come and talk to this group, and I'll try not to take the edge off the pizza, which is clearly the prime attraction. But I was a graduate student once, too. I'll tell you a little bit about myself, what I do, and then I'm going to talk a little bit about news media and the press and why they're important. I'll talk a little bit about some of the players, the people who are engaged in this process, and a little bit about how the process unfolds, and also we'll talk about resources that are available for faculty, staff, and students who may be anticipating an encounter with news media or who may want to try to work proactively with news media. I've been working on this campus, communicating science, for about 26 years now. And I cover everything from astrophysics to zoonotic disease. So the whole landscape, which is really a wonderful job, the way I describe it to people is it's a scam. I get paid to hang around with smart people and find out new things before anybody else does, except the scientists, of course. And to try to tell the world about the good work that's done on this campus. So my job really is to kind of open up the lab door a little bit and let the rest of the world take a peek inside, especially the people who are the taxpayers, the people who are paying for this work. It's important that they know about it. And there are three science writers in our office. We're the main communications office for the university, and we have a number of different divisions. We have a marketing division, we have photo, we have a web team, and then there's a research communications team, which I direct, and that includes myself and two other science writers, and also another project that we started about 13 years ago as part of the NSF-funded National Institute for Science Education here. I don't know if anybody remembers that. But this was our Y-Files project, which is a popular science web magazine, which we've been publishing for 13 years. And if you're interested, we cover evolution a lot, and we cover issues of evolution a lot. And so if you're looking for some materials and past coverage, or if you want to see how this issue is covered by a publication like ours, feel free to tap into that. If you just Google Y-Files, it'll come up, or it's, you know, yfiles.org. So I work all over the map. One of my jobs is to do missionary work. It's essentially to proselytize about why it's important for researchers to talk to reporters, to talk to the media, and be engaged in public discussions about their work or about issues related to their work. We're not as probably, you know, most or all of you are acutely aware, we're not a very scientific nation in a lot of ways. There are a lot of issues out there. It's clear that the public doesn't have a very good understanding of some of these issues. And the scary thing is that after people complete their formal education, their primary contact with the scientific enterprise is through popular media, for good or bad. And of course, not everything out there is good. But our role is to tell stories about UW, to try to keep that profile up, and to help explain the scientific enterprise. We're a scientific organization, after all, and you know, the conduct of science is critical to our mission. So I work a lot with professors and their graduate students and their postdocs to try to help them tell their story and to tell them why it's worth doing. It's worth doing because, you know, if you want to look at it from a purely venal perspective, it's in our self-interest because the public funds 99% of the research that goes on in this country, and probably, you know, 95% of the work that goes on at this institution. And it's important that people have a better understanding of science and the scientific process and how it works, and most importantly, why it matters to them. You know, most people are you know, and I think we all take for granted a lot of the scientific developments that affect our lives. But for example, when I was a student here, of course, one of the things that I would have to do after the end of every school year is I'd have to find a new apartment and I'd have to move. And back in the day when I moved, we'd have to lug around big boxes of albums, vinyl. That was our music. You know, in the intervening 30 years, there have been developments in chemistry and physics and material science to the point where now you can take all of that music that you used to have to lug up and down, you know, narrow, creaky staircases in Madison and put it in your pocket. Those kinds of developments tend to be lost, obviously, to an iPod or an MP3 player. There are a lot of little steps in the scientific process and in terms of how technology is developed. But it's those little steps that are important. And sometimes in science there are big steps as well. For example, stem cells, human embryonic stem cells. That was something that we were, you know, made aware of well in advance of the original paper publishing, and we spent about 6 months preparing for announcing that research. What I do with faculty is once they're engaged, we work with them to find out. A lot of times we key off of papers that are published in the literature. Those provide what we call in the business a hook to hang a story on. It gives us an opportunity to write about research, and it's an appropriate time as well because the work has gone through peer review. And we, you know, we're journalists or writers, and we're not experts. So we depend much as scientists do on the process to validate the things that we're trumpeting about the university and about the people who work here. We may write about, you know, a discrete bit of work that's published somewhere. One of the hardest things I have to do is distinguish for faculty, you know, what's newsworthy and what's noteworthy. Of course, you know, it's all important. We think all the work is done here is important, but not all of it sort of rises to the level of news. But when something does, we'll work closely with a faculty member. We'll develop, a news release or other materials. We have a videographer in our office, so we might do video. We have photographers. We have a very good web team. So there are different kinds of products that we can produce, and then we work. We've spent a lot of time and resources developing networks of reporters and news organizations that we work with that are interested in getting news about the University of Wisconsin and the research that goes on here. Organizations that are hungry for it. When we send something out the door, it's amazing how quickly it pops up on websites all over the world. Very, very quickly. You know, you can see that people have RSS feeds right to our news things. So we're in the Hindustan Times immediately after something goes out the door. But we place a priority. A news release is a very general description of a bit of work. It's usually about, 700 or 800 words, so it's not very long. And it's written in lay language. So most reporters don't have a background in science. Some do. People in the cohort that I hang around with science writers and science journalists, they tend to get on that track either through journalism or through science. The other science writer currently working in our office has a PhD in neuroscience. So there are people who are right about science who are quite knowledgeable about it and about the process. But there are lots of people who are not. These are journalists, folks who are generalists, and even science writers, people who specialize about a particular area, are really generalists because we're all over the place. You know, one day it's swine flu, and the next day it's black holes, and you kind of have to really be sort of nimble in your ability to sort of navigate the different disciplines. But what's really important are sort of the underlying things. You know, how does science work? You know, what's important from the scientist's perspective? What's really the significance of this work, and that helps direct us in how we work with faculty. We work with journalists at all levels, from student reporters at the Daily Cardinal and the Badger Herald, who usually call us at about 10 o'clock at night, trying to get an interview with the chancellor. I kid you not, this happens on a weekly basis. All the way up to the New York Times, and pretty much every day. So we're a very busy news office. There is a really a keen interest in the work that goes on at this place, and one of the things that I frequently encounter is people have a perception that Wisconsin doesn't reflect much in the news in terms of research. You know, I hear this a lot, and I've heard it for years and years. Well, I see it all. It crosses my desk every day. And we're reflected very well and quite broadly around the world. And also, if you have a chance to travel and you talk to people know the research reputation of the University of Wisconsin. And that's been due to the hard work of a lot of different people over a long period of time. So there's a demand for this information. It does get reflected well. It does have to go through filters. It has to go through people like me, and then it has to go through journalists. And then journalists have gatekeepers as well. When they write their stories, they turn them in, and they're edited, and somebody else writes the headline. So there's a process, and knowing the process and how it works is really critical to being effective and successful in how you do this kind of work, and that's where people like me come in. I mean, we are a resource for faculty. Anybody can call me up and say, "Hey, I've got something that I think is interesting or new." We're happy to take a look. You know, we might not be able to help in every case, but we're always, anxious to find out about things and ready to listen and to provide advice and help where we can. It's a resource that people should feel comfortable with. If you're a graduate student and you're going to go on into a career in science, you'll encounter people like me at whatever institution you end up at, these are folks who will be pests. They'll want to know what's going on in your lab. You know, tell me what's new. What's interesting that's coming up that we can write about. If you're lucky, they'll be good at it. It's important not only to let the rest of the world know, but it's also increasingly helpful. When I first started doing this kind of work, ages ago, it was sometimes hard for me to get in the door to talk to faculty. You know, there was nothing in their reward system for engaging in this kind of behavior. In fact, they could be penalized for it. You know, they might be viewed as grandstanding or showboating, so they may in fact have been penalized for it. But it's different. About 15 or 20 years ago, people like Neil Lane at the National Science Foundation started going around and talking to researchers and saying, "You have to get out of your lab and tell people why your work is important. Otherwise, the money's not going to be there anymore." I mean, he's talking in a large way, not specifically threatening anybody's grant funding. But saying that, it's important for scientists to have a public voice, to really explain their work and why it matters. And even if there's no practical upshot to it, it's important, it matters. And that message is getting through. NIH is giving the same message these days to folks. And, you know, it might even make a difference, all else being equal, in terms of a grant application, if there's a project that has gotten some attention or has the prospect of getting some public attention, that might tip the balance in favor of a funded grant proposal as opposed to one that's not. And I'm increasingly encountering things like that where faculty are telling me, yes, this is important. We know that this helps us when we go back. And we work with the funding agencies. We ship off whatever we write to the appropriate agency, make sure they know about it, try to give them advance word. NSF in particular has ramped up their efforts to publicize science news and to work with people like me. And you know, they depend on us. We feed them things about NSF-funded investigators on this campus, and you know they can then take those products and they can repurpose them on their own websites. And if the only person that sees a particular story is the program officer for a particular program, that's a good day in the office, because it might in turn help one of our investigators. Which is part of our goals is we want to act in support of the scientific enterprise here. So I've talked a little bit about it, given some introductory blather about what I do and a little bit about process. And my understanding more about how this works is that just kind of we open it up to questions. And,
if you want to.
Okay.
Sure.
All right. And I can continue to blather if you want, but if you have questions, I'm happy to entertain those.
I've got one, Terry. Can you reflect on the first, month after Jamie's paper was published? The life in Terry Devitt's, a day in the life or a month in the life after that. I mean, that had to be intense.
Yeah, it continues to be intense. Fortunately at the time, Jamie Thompson, who's notorious for being a difficult interview to get, at the time he wasn't notorious for that because he wasn't known at all. He was an academic staff scientist tucked away in our primate center doing some obscure work. We found out about this well ahead of time, so we were able to prepare. We were able to, develop websites and things like that and video and other things in anticipation of that. Jamie didn't want to have his picture taken. And I said, well, we can do it, or the guy in the bushes outside your house can do it. Your choice. So he let us take his picture. It was interesting working up to that because there was a competing paper from a group at Johns Hopkins. Jamie's paper had been accepted at Science, and I worked very closely with the press officers at Science, and we were just kind of watching. This was kind of research that we thought the embargo would break. Somebody would break the embargo on it. And we actually, what we do when we have, there are a lot of times, everybody know what a news embargo is? Okay. The journals, especially the bigger journals like Science and Nature and PNAS, they have what's called an embargo system, a news embargo system, meaning they will give us a heads up about a paper, or if we've trained the faculty member well enough, the faculty member will give us even more notice, and we might have a week or two to prepare something in anticipation of a paper publishing. But we'll prepare news materials in advance. Based on the paper and my conversation with a faculty member, we'll write the story up. I'll give them a chance to review the story, correct all my egregious mistakes. add anything that they want to add, as long as they don't, re-jargonize it. Then we will have, we'll have something in anticipation of a paper publishing. Then we will, the journal will say you can release the news on such and such a day and time, and it's usually a standard time. With science, I think it's like 1 o'clock on a Thursday afternoon, something like that, the day before the print magazine hits the street. So they have these embargo systems, and reporters sign blood oaths that they will abide by these embargo systems. Otherwise, they don't get the running start at the story. So we had an embargo news release posted to a website called Eureka Alert, which is run by AAAS, and it's a password-protected website where you can post embargoed news and where reporters go and they shop for news. They'll go there Monday morning and they'll take a look and try to see what the science story du jour is going to be. We had posted it up there. It was very interesting because we were fearful that this news would leak out. And I posted it, and really nothing happened for a while. And in fact, Nicholas Wade, who's a science writer for the New York Times, called me the day after we had posted it. And I said, well, I bet I know why you're calling. And he said, oh, why? And I said, human embryonic stem cells. I said, the news release went up yesterday on Eureka Alert, and then, he obviously had to track it down and then called me back about 10 minutes later. he had a new story that he was writing. And so we were working with reporters in advance of Thursday embargo lift, and we actually had somebody monitoring the internet. Just to see if the story was going to break anywhere, if the embargo was going to be compromised. Interestingly enough, that didn't happen, but the first inklings, the early embryonic stem cell work, if you recall, had to be privately funded. So Wharf had funded some of it, and a company called Geron, which is a publicly traded company, had funded it. So, I could have made a lot of money off of this. I could either be here giving this talk on a beach somewhere, retired, or in jail. So here I am. I took the safest option.
What was the contingency plan in the event? If the embargo is broken, is it all hell breaks loose?
If the embargo breaks, it breaks. The journals will punish anybody who they think broke the embargo by cutting them off. But once something's out there, it's out there. You can't put it back. It's like toothpaste out of the tube. And nothing you can really do except go. And usually what happens if an embargo breaks, what happens is the journals will put out, they'll send out an email to journalists that they work with saying, the embargo has been lifted because of the premature break on this. So once it's out there, it's out there. But the first inkling that we got that people were talking about this publicly was that the guy we had listening on the internet was starting to pick up stuff in chat rooms, back in the day of chat rooms, for stock traders, saying, there were messages going back and forth. What's going on with Geron? Buy Geron. And I was like, this is getting kind of dicey. This was the day of. Nobody knows who was, out there talking about it. But Geron's stock just soared that day. It went up some astronomical amount. But anyway, to get back to your question, Kevin, fortunately the office next to mine was vacant, and Jamie was in that office for 2 weeks. Doing nothing but taking phone calls. We decided that we did not want to do a news conference because of the controversial nature of the work. We didn't want to have any kind of uncontrolled environment where the controversial nature of the work would somehow overshadow the science. And so we opted to basically do media one at a time. And this typically doesn't happen on our news releases. Usually we will put names and contact information of the investigator right up at the top of the news release, and reporters don't have to go through us. They can go directly to the horse's mouth. It's not our job to get in the middle. We don't feel. Some universities behave differently. They tend to funnel all everything through the press officer. But we take sort of the public part of our institution very seriously, and we try to facilitate but not filter any kinds of press interactions with our faculty, staff, or students. But in this case, it was my name and number that were up at the top, so my phone just started ringing. And it didn't stop ringing for pretty much a month. And I would take names and phone numbers and the names of the organizations, and I would do a triage. I'd make a list, and then I'd walk next door and I'd hand it to Jamie, and Jamie returned the phone calls one at a time, and didn't do anything but that for about 2 weeks. He entertained himself in between calls by watching Jaron Stock go through the roof. He didn't own Jaron Stock either, you know. So that was the other thing that we did in anticipation of that. The institution, obviously, there were lots of, you know, Jamie's also a very careful scientist because of the I think in part that's his nature, but also because of the controversial nature of the work. He was extremely careful with how that was done. So, you know, clearly all, you know, the IRB had, you know, signed off. Everything there was copacetic. And then the institution put it through another layer of ethical review. And again, we did this in anticipation of that. We wanted to make sure nobody owned stock in this company, that, you know, that the consent forms from patients were in order and were as good as we could get them. And that, you know, in terms of the ethics of how this was done, that we weren't exposed in any way. And I was really grateful and appreciative of that. And the institution did a really, really good job there, and we didn't have any problems with that. So it was very busy, and my phone has been ringing ever since about stem cells. And now most of the time, what I have to tell reporters is, you know, I'm sorry, you can't get an interview with Jamie Thompson because he gets too many requests, and that's all he would do. And that's really kind of his preference. He doesn't really seek out a lot of attention. He's the one faculty member in the portfolio of people that I work with that has that privilege. Pretty much everybody else has to tell the reporter that themselves if they don't want to talk to them. So, but we do go in and help if there are issues with you know, a journalist or a story or something like that. You know, we're happy to mediate. And oftentimes, because we've worked in the business for a long time, we know most of the people who cover science around the country and beyond, and we have personal relationships with these folks, and so we can call them and talk to them about a particular issue. And most reporters are, you know, what reporters, anybody know what reporters want? They really want?
College.
They just want a story. They want a story. That's all they want. They're not after you. They're not after the institution. They want a good story, and you know, we hook them up with good stories. So they, you know, savvy reporters tend to value the services that people like me provide to them, and you know, faculty are sort of increasingly coming around and they appreciate the things that we help them do as well. I'll stop there and take another question.
So most of us aren't going to get a news story like that. Mm-hmm. But so suppose that I have a paper and I know that within my scientific community it's going to be fairly exciting. So how do I get that out to the larger public? I mean, what would be the timeline and what can you help me with?
Mm-hmm. Well, the best time to get in touch with us, and the first thing the best piece of advice I can get you is to call early, and often. You know, it's never too early to call, but it can be too late. When I hear from people that say, oh, we had this great, wonderful paper that published last week or 2 weeks ago, you know, you'll have to write about this. It's like, oh. I'm, you know, it's called news for a reason. And when you do the follow-up study, give me a call ahead of time before the paper publishes, and then maybe I can help you. Maybe when the paper's accepted. And it's really hard to judge in this day and age of electronic publishing, because sometimes when, some journals, they accept it, and boom, it's up there, you know, right away. So if you have a hunch that the paper's going to be accepted and that's going to make a splash in your field, what I encourage you to do is to call us or email us and send us the manuscript. We're not going to compromise it in any way. That's not our job. But we do need to know what the study is. And if you could, in your email message or in your phone conversation, just say, you know, here's the paper, here's what we've done, and here's why it matters. Here's what's really got people excited in our community. And not everything is going to be like stem cells, and not everybody can be like somebody like Sean Carroll, who's a genuine rock star. To me, finding stories here is really easy. It's really the hard part is the joy and the frustration of working at being a press officer, a science press officer at a place like this is that there's so much work, there's so much good research out there, the joyful part of it is if you're the least bit interested, it's like, you know, every day is like something really new and interesting and fun, and the frustrating part is that there are a lot of good stories that never get told. And one, because of, you know, limits on our resources, or two, because people didn't think that people might be interested in this. There are a lot of different reasons that things don't get covered. But bug us. Don't do it too often, and don't do it for every paper that you have. There are some people who do that. You know, every paper they publish, they'll, you know, send it along, And that kind of forces us to do some triage, which we don't really want to do. We don't want to be in a position of saying, "Yeah, this is pretty pedestrian. I don't want to cover this one. You know, send me the next one." Choose it carefully. We rely on you. You're the experts to tell us, you know, why it's significant. And then we'll run with it. You know, we'll work with you. We'll put materials together, and get them out there. And, you know, the only thing that we require is your active participation. You have to participate in the process. Meaning, if you're not going to be available after we put out the news release, we're not going to put out the news release. You have to be around and you have to play. It's kind of. What it does is you'll have a spike of activity in your life where you might get some phone calls or some emails from people. The story will get covered, and then it's yesterday's news. It goes on and you go on with your life and wait for the next big paper to come out. We do write things in other ways. We don't just write about news that's published. We'll cover research in different in-university periodicals. On Wisconsin is a wonderful quarterly glossy publication that goes to 350,000 of our closest friends. So it's a very loud in-house organ, if you will. We have a terrific web presence and web team. They do amazing work. And we're starting to explore other kinds of venues for getting things out and doing things differently. I don't know if you saw this. Some of you maybe know or are participating, but there's a group. It's not just biologists, but there are others. There's a group that has an exhibit on microscopy at the Dane County Airport, in the public art space at the Dane County Airport. Beautiful stuff. There's stuff from Sean Carroll Lab, from Hans Scott here, from other folks around campus. Bob Hamer's over in chemistry. Beautiful pictures. And And, you know, one of our plans is well, we did two things with that. One, we knew that NPR has a terrific website, and they have something on there called the Daily Picture Show, which is a new slideshow that they trade out, I guess, every day, with these really, really interesting slideshows, and they're not all about science, obviously. But so I was able to get a PDF of all of these images and send it to the person who puts that together and say, hey, you know, this would fit pretty nicely into that. And she said, yeah, this is great, you know. So, you know, we had to work with them. We had to get the images processed in a way that worked for them once they'd selected their images. Now I'll write the captions for them, and we'll send it off, and probably sometime within the next few weeks, you know, sort of an abbreviated version of this art show of our, you know, interesting stuff from faculty and staff and students will be, you know, prominent on NPR's website. And it's really good. I think it helps sort of another reason to do this, to engage in this behavior, is because it helps validate the work that people do. They can then see that other people are interested and that it matters to them. One of the nicest, you know, emails I got, which I shared with our group, was when we profiled this little tiny art exhibit in a, you know, news release that we did. Our web editor picked out an image that we used to accompany the story, and it turned out it was an image of a graduate student who was in the process of writing her dissertation, and probably in that dark, really bad time when you're writing your dissertation, and she just wrote a note and said, "Yeah, this made my day." You know, I mean, and so those are, you know, so it's helpful. It helps validate the work that people do, and shows that it's meaningful to society in different ways. So that's another reason for doing it. But we're experimenting with lots of different things. There's another project which I plan to cover this summer, which I hope to do with video as well as with imagery. This has to do with testing something called a technology called jellies, which is invented by a guy over in civil engineering. And what it is it's a way to turn over the water in lakes, in a small lake, so that the temperature can be even from top to bottom. Basically, it's a way to turn over the water in a lake with so that you can study the effects of global warming. We have a history at this university of doing whole lake experiments. But what it is, it's just like this giant diaphragm with an inflatable ring around it that they sink to the bottom of the lake, and they can inflate it, you know, and it goes up and goes, you know, deflated, it goes down, and they, you know, they can do this. So this, to me, this is a very visual, this is a really good story. Plus, I can hook it to, you know, the issues of climate change and how climate change might affect one of Wisconsin's most important resources. You might have heard that Minnesota has 10,000 lakes, Wisconsin has 15,000 lakes. Okay. So Minnesota's our pikers when it comes to lakes. When it comes to lakes. So
we undercount.
But that's not about published research. That's about the process of science. And showing the process is also one of the things that we try to do, and that's something we try to do a lot in our Y-Files project, is to show how science gets done. Because to a lot of people, science is a pretty mysterious and forbidding process. Scientists have done a really good job of removing themselves from public conversations by, you know, shrouding their work in, you know, a language and symbology that only the initiated can understand. And they do that for a good reason. We understand that, but to be able to bring it to everybody else, we have to put it in a form and show it in ways through video or pictures or words, so that people can absorb that information and gain some appreciation for the work that's done.
Actually, you touch on something that I'm interested in. Scientists are generally good at relating their results and their interpretations to other scientists, but are notoriously poor at communicating with the public. Mm-hmm. What can your office do to, you know, if you have the B list of scientists, you know, that are poor and communicating with the public? What do you do in that case? Is there any coaching? Is there any?
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, and generally, I don't find scientists to be poor communicators. You know, as a rule, they're actually pretty good, especially when you get them talking about their work. You know, then if you get them, you know, if you get them talking about their work, they, you know, that passion starts to come through. You know, why they got into the business in the first place, and they actually do a pretty good job of explaining it. Some are obviously better than others, but. You know, our office, we offer workshops for faculty, staff, and students. We don't discriminate, but the workshops can be day-long workshops. It can be half-day workshops. It can be customized workshops. If, for example, there's a lab or a group of people that wants to learn how to, you know, interact effectively, we call it charm school. If they want to learn how to interact effectively with media, you know, we'll do that with them. The day-long workshops tend to be fairly elaborate with role-playing. You might be videotaped, you know, and then we'll play back the tape and see how you did, and evaluate that, and just give you tips on how to work with that. So we can do that. We can work individually with people if somebody's got, you know, something that they want to communicate that they think is important. We'll work with those folks and give them advice about how to work with reporters and with others. I mean, and, you know, right now the media landscape is changing, and along with everybody else, we're really struggling to figure out how we're going to communicate with people, you know, in sort of a new world. I grew up in a print orientation. You know, my background was in working for newspapers, and you know, now I go into a journalism class and I'll ask, you know, what, you know, how many of you have actually picked up a newspaper and read a print newspaper today? And this is a journalism class, you know, and maybe three or four hands will go up. You know, people are getting, you know, and it's sort of working its way through the population, starting with young people, the early adopters. They're getting their information in other ways. And so we're trying to, you know, along with everybody else, trying to figure out how, you know, how best to get that information across to people. So we might talk with you about how we might want to do, you know, convey a particular bit of research. If it's very visual, there might be some, you know, some things we can do that are helpful, but basically advice and hand-holding, you know, we can work with reporters as well.
Do these workshops cost anything?
No, the big cost is time.
Okay.
You know, it's hard to get a faculty member for a whole day for anything, although sometimes they'll make that commitment, they don't cost anything. You can, if you call in our office, John Lucas. John is the person who coordinates these workshops, mm-hmm. and I help out. I used to teach. I taught them for about 10 or 12 years, and John's taken over that role now. We put a wide variety of people through.
Were you at the Darwin Day event where they had the panel discussion at the end?
No, I missed that.
Okay. I was thinking that it would be really good to have that sort of thing where we have a panel of reporters and scientists at the end of a workshop like this, mm-hmm. to discuss some of the highlights.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's good. People are interested, you know. I mean, I still read three print newspapers a day, and I read probably maybe two or three more online. But, you know, I challenge you to pick up a daily publication of any kind and not find science news front and center. It's there. People are interested in it, and it makes up a big part of the news budget on any given day. That's what we've got going on now with swine flu, and you know, that's taken up a huge part of a shrinking news hole. But you know, people are really truly interested in this stuff, and you know, they want to know about it, and it becomes important in terms of public policy For example, I mean, you know, the whole evolution versus intelligent design creationism thing, you know, I mean, that's been, you know, a fascinating and in some ways an aggravating phenomena over the last 10 years. It's gotten, you know, it seems to have gotten worse in some ways, and I think part of that is due to the fact that the people who are promoting intelligent design and creationism in the science classroom are getting savvier at working with media and getting their side of the story out there in places where it's receptive. I think scientists are doing a better job of confronting that. They're doing a much better job of confronting that. I'm very impressed. I lurk on the on Mara's listserv, and it's very interesting to me to see how people are mobilized and react when things happen. And I think that's really good. It's really important to do that, because the part of the debate that you have to get across is a lot more complicated than what the other side of the debate has to get across. And the other thing that you confront, the other challenge is that a lot of reporters are not, you know, they're reporters for a reason. They were scared by somebody in a white coat in utero. And, you know, they don't have a lot of science background. They may have none at all. They may have an agenda. Making sure we're able to cut through that and get the important scientific messages across to people becomes more and more important.
I have a question, mm-hmm. like related, for example, to the swine flu. Mm-hmm. There's been a lot of news about it, mm-hmm. but from what I've understood talking with people who are not, you know, familiar with viruses and stuff, there is no information to them about why should they be worried, mm-hmm. or, you know, what is it about this virus? I mean, it's all information about so many mm-hmm. cases in so many places, but
right.
nothing about
right.
giving data so they have a better sense of, you know, what's really going on. I mean, we mm-hmm. can figure it out because we know enough,
right.
but they can't.
Right, right.
And why, you know, wouldn't that be an important part of science news to have somewhere so people who want to know can learn?
Absolutely. I agree. And I think there's probably some stuff out there, I think, because a lot of people have been communicating about this. It's really quite interesting how this has sort of taken over the news the last few days. And I think it's interesting, the point you make is interesting, because I think what's really driving the concern about this is exactly the point that you're making, is that what's happened here, and we've worried for a long time about bird flu, but bird flu, while it's infected people, those people have tend to be infected from animals, and it had the virus hasn't evolved to the point where it's transmissible from human to human. And that's what this virus apparently has done, is that it's you know, humans are transmitting it to each other, and you don't have to be in contact with, you know, chickens or pigs to get it. I haven't looked around, but I suspect that if I look a little bit, I could probably find an explanation of, you know, why that's of concern.
Right.
But it's not.
I'm sure you can. What I'm saying is, I've looked at the newspaper, you know,
mm-hmm.
the front lines and on the web, and, you know, that's not the major. That's not
right.
what makes
I
the
saw,
front
I
page
I saw one
right
of those
now.
Yesterday, somebody laying through how you get the flu, because a lot of people were afraid to buy pork.
Yeah. Right.
Well, I
right.
know. It
yeah,
gets
they,
to
yeah,
be
exactly.
distorted. That's
yeah.
why I'm trying to
yeah.
say. They
that's why I heard they were
going to
rename it, not call it swine flu
yeah,
anymore,
yeah.
because
yeah.
the pork
yeah.
industry
yeah.
was worried.
Yeah.
Well,
that was
their
girl. It's like changing.
The other aspect of this particular story is that evidently it arose on a huge pig farm.
Mm-hmm. American-owned.
Pardon?
American-owned in Mexico.
Yeah, and, you know, that raises the issue of factory farms
mm-hmm.
and how we're treating animals.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it gets into the whole animal rights
sure.
aspect, as well as the rights of, you know, small farmers versus
mm-hmm.
big farmers. I mean, it has at least three different areas.
Right. Right.
And with climate change and the growing population, you're going to see more of these outbreaks.
Mm-hmm. Right, and actually one of the calls I took yesterday was from a reporter who was not looking for an expert on swine flu. She was looking for an expert on pig farming. And she'd sort of been, I think, probably didn't think of this on her own. I think she was goosed by groups that are concerned about that kind of agriculture. Mm-hmm. And they raised that issue with her, and she was following up and looking for an expert on, on hog farming.
If you're interested, Discovery Channel News actually has a lot of really good information in lay terms about it.
Right, but that's what they do. I mean, what I'm trying to say is in the general, this is one view, and the people who will look there, but in the major newspapers and stuff, it would be nice if together with the big news there was a little bit of an explanation.
Right.
So people had a sense of, you can worry everybody, but they don't tell you what you have to worry about, and people don't know. I mean, if you've talked to people who are not biologists recently, they don't have a clue
to worry
about.
That's the thing. I mean, it's so early right now. There's so many more questions than answers. I was just thinking.
Right, but they
your phone
worry.
Conversations must go pretty much like this. Yeah, I got nothing.
yeah. Well, we actually happen to have a swine flu expert here on campus, Chris Olson, over in the vet school. Somebody who studied it and who's actually has been working with CDC on this outbreak. So we have really some of the best flu people in the world on this campus. One of the things you're seeing too is an artifact of the news process and the resources that are available. You know, what we have every day is what we call it a news hole. It's the amount of space that's left over in the newspaper or on a broadcast after you've sold all the ads. Okay, and that hole, that's getting smaller and smaller, and so stories are getting smaller and smaller and shorter. And so what a reporter has to do is they have to start off with, basically the sort of a top tier of information, and then it's called the inverted pyramid. It's basically the most important stuff goes up, and then they kind of work their way down. And the point you're making is a very interesting one.
Website,
valid.
Just the website. Nervous because this is a pure example where you can create a total panic in the world.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah.
And,
absolutely.
That's not warranted, and it will all be because of how the news was handled.
Believe me, I'm dealing with people who are panicked. Including people at the university, because of course the university has to prepare.
Yeah, we already got a few emails yesterday.
For a pandemic, and there are some people who are just like, calm down.
Well, it'll only take one good mutation, and that virus will have.
Yeah. So are you a virologist?
No.
Thank you very much.
Sure. Yeah, thanks for inviting me.
I'll have to let people go to the next.
Thanks for having me. I'm sorry. I did bring a handout if anybody was interested, so that might be helpful.
Thank you.